Hello, and welcome to a Nutrition and Clinical Practice podcast. I'm Dr. Kristen Roberts, Deputy Editor for Nutrition and Clinical Practice. The theme for the April issue of NCP is new and emerging nutrition support therapies. Joining me today is Dr. Thangam Venkatesan, the senior author of the paper we are discussing today titled Cannabis Use in the United States and Its Impact on Gastrointestinal Health. Dr. Venkatesan is faculty in the Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology and Nutrition within the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you, Dr. Venkatesan, for joining me today.
Thank you, Kristen, for having me.
Before we start our discussion, I'd like to ask if you have any disclosures on the topic that you would like to share.
I don't have any relevant disclosures to this particular topic.
Okay, great. Before we begin discussing the review of your article, can you please provide the listeners with an overview of your clinical practice and how this topic fits into your area of expertise?
So, Kristen, my area of clinical and research expertise is in a condition called cyclic vomiting syndrome. And for those viewers out there or listeners out there, cyclic vomiting syndrome is basically a disorder which is characterized by recurrent stereotypic episodes of profound nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain and other symptoms, and patients can be very sick. They are usually sort of go back to normal health or baseline health in between episodes, and this is something that I've been working on for more than 15 years. Another intriguing aspect of this disorder is actually cannabis use in this patient population. And as we all know, cannabis is really being legalized in so many states, and I really think it's very important. Another thing that I actually am very interested in and I've worked on is endocannabinoid signaling. So again, for listeners, we also produce marijuana-like substances called endocannabinoids, which are very important in the regulation of stress, nausea, and vomiting. So I think in a nutshell, that is my area of interest.
Yeah, it's such a unique aspect on GI health that I'm excited to talk with you more about this paper. My first kind of question for you is, really more of a comment. I've really appreciated how you introduce cannabis trends in the U.S. to start your paper, just to help us all understand how things have changed over time. Can you discuss how cannabis trends have changed over time and share with us the impact that cannabis legalization had on these trends?
Yes. So that is really a very important question that you ask. And unfortunately or fortunately, cannabis use has significantly increased, especially over the past decade. So one, you can look at the frequency of cannabis use. And if you look at some data, almost 21% of everybody in the U.S. population has used cannabis at least once, which is dramatically different. The use of cannabis has gone up in pretty much all age groups. It's not just young adults, but it's young adult, middle-aged people, elderly people, and so on. And so that's very alarming. Cannabis use has actually increased in both genders. And now there's also a significant increase in females, while in the past it was mostly in males. In fact, there's alarming data that cannabis use has even increased among pregnant women. So that's regarding the frequency, really, of cannabis use. Now, if you look at the potency of cannabis use, this again is very important. For instance, there was a study that was done and they looked at samples of cannabis that was used maybe about two decades ago. And the percentage, so when you talk about cannabis, there are two important constituents. You have THC or tetrahydrocannabinol, which kind of gives you the high. And then you have CBD, which is a non-psychotropic agent. And so this really is present in a certain ratio in really the plant. And if you look at weed, say, that was smoked about 20 years ago or so, the percentage of the concentration of THC was 4%. 20 years later, it's actually about 14% or so. So it's significantly increased. And also, if you look at the way cannabis is produced these days, you can actually have cannabis products, and you do have cannabis products on the market that now have even 75 to 80% concentrations of THC. And so I think the product that you're getting is very different from what you were getting about 20 years ago. And certainly that is going to, impact what it really has as far as effects on not only GI function, but pretty much everything in the body. So to kind of summarize, I think, I mean, if you look at cannabis trends, one, it's, you know, obviously the frequency of use and the potency of use. And then there's another actually interesting piece of data that I wanted to share with you, and is the perception of cannabis. So a lot of people about 20 years ago thought that cannabis was actually risky. And if you look at these trends, you find that there's a dramatic decrease in how patients or the general population sort of views it. So most people actually don't perceive it to be risky at all. So certainly, I'm not sure that that's all based on good evidence, but that's what we have today.
And hearing you talk a little bit about potency, I think that kind of leads into my next question. For listeners that are unfamiliar with cannabis metabolism, can you briefly describe the mechanism of action for cannabis and how this impacts the GI tract specifically?
That's a good question again, Christian. And so, you know, again, for those who are unfamiliar with this topic, when you talk about cannabis, it's what we call a cannabinoid. And there are different types of cannabinoids. So there's something called phytocannabinoids, and that essentially is referring to cannabis, which comes from the plant. You have endocannabinoids, and I alluded to this a little earlier. So these are marijuana-like substances that are produced in the body. And then, of course, you have cannabinoids that are produced or synthesized in the laboratory. Now, when you talk about cannabis or phytocannabinoids, they obviously have been around for a very, very long time. And they actually act on receptors. There are two kinds of receptors. They're called CB1 or cannabinoid type 1 receptors, and then CB2 or cannabinoid type 2 receptors. Now, cannabinoid 1 or CB1 receptors are actually densely distributed in multiple areas of the brain that are important for the regulation of stress, nausea, and vomiting. And then the cannabinoid 2 or CB2R or CB2 receptors are found in many areas in the GI tract, in the periphery, in immune cells and plasma cells. They're very important and play a role in inflammation and so on and so forth. And so when these phytocannabinoids or endocannabinoids can act on these CB1 receptors and CB2 receptors, and then they have multiple functions. And so if this is all kind of, if your endocannabinoid system is working well, then it really kind of helps the host remain in homeostasis. It helps you regulate stress. It prevents people from, you know, kind of developing any nausea and vomiting. It has an important role in sleep, in metabolism, in obesity, and so many other functions.
So throughout your paper, you did a really thorough review of all the human studies involving cannabis use and GI function, and it still seemed that the data was quite limited. So despite this, does there seem to be certain patient populations that may benefit from cannabis use for symptom management? And if so, can you share with our listeners which patient populations might have the most promise with symptom relief for using these types of plants?
Yeah. For instance, cannabis, either smoking or edibles, are widely used in the U.S. for multiple medical conditions. And if you look at surveys of different respondents in the U.S., you find that they use it for pain and sleep and so many other conditions, cancer, anorexia, anxiety, and depression. But if you actually look at the hard data, I don't know that we have a great deal of evidence to support its use. Now, I can give you some examples of some patient populations where there is some evidence. For example, you have Marinol or Nabilone or Dronabinol, and these agents can help with chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. So there are certainly some studies looking at chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting using these agents. Now, there are, like I said, CBD, which is a non-psychotropic agent. So it doesn't give you the high, at least in the doses that you typically should use it. So they have studied CBD in certain patient populations. If you look at the use of CBD, you know, there's a specific maybe patient population, children with epilepsy, where CBD has been shown to have effect. In GI disorders, there were a couple of recent trials. Again, these trials were sort of really short. They were only 4-week trials. There was one study in functional dyspepsia. Again, this is a condition for listeners where you have abdominal pain. And they actually found that it did not have any significant benefit. Now, however, the same group did another study. They looked at patients with gastroparesis, and they did find some improvement in symptoms. And really, these patients kind of tolerated food better and were able to eat a little better. So there are some instances, I think, in some patient populations where this can sort of benefit them. Pain and sleep is a big one. But again, I don't know that there's great data for that. Now, there are some other studies coming out of Israel where they looked at cannabis use in some patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And there were some studies which showed some, maybe some moderate benefit. So I will say, as far as hard evidence, there are few patient populations and few chronic conditions where there seems to be some benefit by using these products. And really, I think, unfortunately, legalization has outpaced research in this area. And so I think we'll need a lot more research. I certainly think there's a lot of potential, not generally by using cannabis per se, but like I said, there are many agents like endocannabinoids, and then there are some agents that actually can prevent the degradation of endocannabinoids in your body. They're called FA inhibitors, fatty acid amylase hydrolase. And so there are multiple agents where perhaps we can manipulate the endocannabinoid system to our benefit, but I don't think we're there yet.
Well, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit on you here. In your paper, you talked about the impact of cannabis on the gut microbiome. And we've talked about the gut microbiome so many times in these podcasts, but this is a really unique aspect of this. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of clarify for listeners what we know about how cannabis impacts our microbiome. And then just to speculate a little bit, do you think that there's any connection for this yet with clinical practice, or is it too soon to really be connecting this with any health implications?
Yeah. So Kristen, that's actually a very, fascinating topic. And there are multiple, preclinical studies, and certainly there's a lot of work that's going on in this area. And so, like you said, first you have the gut-brain connection, right? So we all know that there's a connection between the brain and the gut and the vagus nerve and so on. And certainly, being a gastroenterologist, I think, it's time to listen to our gut, if you will. And so what happens is, one, there is this connection, bidirectional connection between the brain and the gut. And like I mentioned previously, for the listeners, it's like you have these cannabinoid receptors, and you also have production of endocannabinoids in the periphery, in areas of the gut and so on. So you have CB1 and CB2 receptors in the gut. And so you can actually change endocannabinoid signaling in the gut. And you can do that by changing your diet. Antibiotics can, certainly change the microbiome, probiotics and prebiotics. And by changing the microbiome, you can actually cause changes in endocannabinoid signaling. And then when you change the endocannabinoid signaling, you can actually affect multiple functions in the body. This will include like stress, it will include so many other conditions, gut-brain disorders, and so on. And so I think there's really a huge connection between all of this. And if you alter one thing, something else happens, and so on. So there's actually multiple studies looking at these things.
So it just seems like, as with so many conditions, that we're always in need of more research. So as one of my parting questions for you, what are some areas of research that you feel should be prioritized to answer necessary questions related to cannabis use and GI function or health?
So the thing with cannabis use is that, and certainly we know that cannabinoids actually play a big role in various GI disorders, and we didn't talk about it a lot, but one area of interest, or one disorder in particular, cyclic vomiting syndrome, and also what is called cannabinoid hyperemesis, which is very similar to CVS. In fact, we think it's a subset of CVS and may be worsened by cannabis use. And I think one is a priority, right? So I think we need a lot of funding. So first, I think the NIH and NIDA and the NIDDK, I think really need to prioritize this as areas which are important for human health and really GI health in the US and pretty much everywhere. So one is, I think, funding. And two is making these areas like cannabis use and GI disorders a priority so that it allows investigators to really look a little more deeply into how cannabis is affecting it. For instance, there are very few good studies. We did a study looking at cannabis use patterns. And because a lot of people still, you know, get it through various routes, there is very little regulation in the industry. So we really don't know what a certain person is consuming. Somebody says, hey, I'm using X amount of cannabis, but it's not like buying, say, Tylenol from your pharmacy. So you don't know the unit of cannabis that is present in any product. So, just looking at cannabis products and making sure that there's regulation, making understanding how much somebody is either smoking or consuming via an edible and how this affects sort of human or GI health, I really think is an area of priority.
I think you've given us a lot to think about from this interview today and just how this is impacting all of us working in gastroenterology. With that, that concludes our interview today. Are there any parting words that you want to share with our listeners that you didn't get a chance to address today?
No, I think you had very insightful questions and, we really covered a lot of ground here. But like I said, it's really a lot of engagement. And for listeners out there, both investigators, patients, and the audience, I think it's very important that everybody works collaboratively to better understand without really being judgmental about how cannabis can affect GI health.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with our listeners today. I invite our listeners to find out more about new and emerging nutrition support therapies in the upcoming issue of Nutrition and Clinical Practice. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me, Kristen.